Where are you from? The Uber driver asked while I gazed out the window during our drive from Honolulu International Airport to my hotel in Waikiki Beach. I looked over and saw his face through the rearview mirror. Florida, I answered, trying to hold back the tears that were hiding behind my aviator glasses. I shifted my gaze to look outside on this sunny September day. Cool. I was stationed there once when I was in the Navy. How long are you here for? He asked curiously. I'm not sure, I said, keeping my gaze out the window, praying for something to snap me out of my gloom. I was tired. I attempted to fly the Bonanza across the Pacific Ocean a few days ago with not much success. On the morning of my departure, I showed up at the airport at 4:30 a.m. and started to fuel the airplane, including the two internal tanks inside. I had to make sure I had enough fuel on board to get me from Hawaii to California. I taxied as slow as a snail to runway 8 right, a 12,000-foot runway, and took off, like a test pilot, with the aircraft's weight far exceeding the manufacturer's limitation. From there, I nursed the airplane up to 5,000 feet and then to 7,000 feet, headed towards the Bay Area. The whole experience was nerve-wracking and very tense. A few hours into the flight and a handful of fuel calculations, I realized that I wasn't going to make it. I had an unexpected headwind and I would be 20 minutes short on fuel before reaching my destination. After these calculations, I heard myself saying, the winds will change, don't worry, keep going. You made it this far, you'll be fine. I stopped these thoughts immediately and told myself that the risk was not worth it. I didn't get this far to start taking shortcuts now. I turned the airplane around. Eventually, I landed back on runway 8 right, parked, sat in the Bonanza, and I cried really hard. I was tired. All I wanted to do was to go home. What do you do? The Uber driver interrupted my thoughts. I'm a pilot, I said. Cool. I took a few lessons before joining the military. It was fun, but expensive. Who do you fly for? There was no way getting out of this conversation, so I shared the details of my flight around the world with him. Cool. Oh my gosh, do you trust me? He said eagerly, about to jump out of his seat. What? Do I trust you? No, I don't know you, I said. I get it, but I must take you to a place. I promise it's 2 minutes out of our way from the hotel. You have to see it. With 911 dialed on my phone, ready for me to hit the call button, I told him that it better be 2 minutes or else I would call the police. A few minutes later, the Uber driver parked on the side of a cliff. Great. Well, this isn't suspicious or scary at all, I told the driver sarcastically, regretting the decision I made. Boy, was I in a mood. I get it, but go check out the rock over there. He pointed to a stone that was as tall as my hip. Comforted by the busy road and all the people around, I jumped out of the car and walked over to the rock, which was peacefully overlooking the beautiful Pacific Ocean. It was a memorial with an engraving on it. Amelia Earhart, the first person to fly alone from Hawaii to North America, January 1935. At that moment, I immediately remembered a quote Amelia once said. Everyone has oceans to fly if they have the heart to do it. Is it reckless? Maybe. But what do dreams know about boundaries? I took off my Ray-Bans and looked into the ocean. For the first time since I had to turn around and cancel my flight to California, I felt something other than numbness and being homesick. I felt the warmth of the sun, the breeze from the ocean. I could smell the salty water. My nerves were slowing down. I felt at peace. Amelia was once here, and so were seven other women before me. They were at this point of tiredness and a great sense of fear. I had to trust that I was going to make it, even though I was flying a single-engine airplane solo for over 14 hours over water. I was going to make it. I was going to be okay. At that moment, with tears streaming down my face and the Uber driver awkwardly looking at me, I took in a deep breath and I felt Amelia's spirit. It was so strong. She started this. She paved the way for women to fly. Specifically, she paved the way for me to fly around the world. Now, I'm not someone who likes to make these sentimental and corny statements, but I have to be honest with you. I never felt a genuine connection between Amelia and her story. It simply didn't resonate with me. Not that I didn't find it inspiring, it just never stuck with me. However, I truly felt her presence there with me, giving me strength to fly with courage into the unknown. It was a special moment which refueled my soul for this last part of the journey. I then remembered another quote by Amelia. She once said, "The best way to do it is to do it." I needed to get back into my loyal Bonanza and fly to the new horizon that was in front of me. I had the heart to do it. Yes, it was scary and perhaps a little reckless, but I had to complete this flight and continue my mission of inspiring people to believe in their dreams. No matter how hard, impossible, or scary their dreams may be. For what do dreams know about boundaries? Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Atlantic Aviation. Atlantic Aviation provides aircraft ground support in over 60 locations across the U.S. I'm proud to be partnered with a company that puts their people first and values diversity and inclusion. Their vision and mission is evident through the various resource programs they support. Experience the Atlantic attitude today. Check out AtlanticAviation.com to see all 60-plus locations and plan your next visit. Today's guest is Nicole Stott. Nicole grew up in Clearwater, Florida. She began her career in 1987 as a structural design engineer with Pratt & Whitney in West Palm Beach, Florida. In 1988, Stott joined NASA at the Kennedy Space Center as an operations engineer in the Orbiter Processing Facility. In April of 2006, she was a crew member on the NEMO mission, which stands for the NASA Extreme Environment Mission Operations, where she lived and worked with a six-person crew for 18 days on the Aquarius Undersea Research Habitat. Nicole has been to space two times. Once in 2009 as a flight engineer on the STS, which stands for Space Transportation System 128, also known as Discovery, participating in the first spacewalk of that mission and returned on the STS 129, also known as Atlantis. Her second time to space was in 2011, where Nicole was a mission specialist on the STS 133. Today, Nicole, who's a mother, is also an artist who shares her passion for space through her work.
She is also the author of the Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It, which comes out on October 12th. Nicole, welcome to the AV with Shasta podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Shasta. It's so nice to be here and to hear and see you. That's a secret, I know, to see you again. thank you so much for the invitation.
Absolutely. So, Nicole, what is one thing that you want people to know about you personally that isn't shared if we were to do like a Google research or a Google search on you?
Oh, wow. I don't, let's see. How about, I think this surprises people, and I think that it's felt by a lot of women in particular, and that I don't tend to have a lot of confidence in myself. I mean, and maybe it's not confidence, but it's there's a level of doubt, I think, that has gone along, has been with me in everything I've done. And always kind of second guessing, like, why would they pick me? I haven't done anything they'd want, you know, why should I even put myself in the running? And you know, things like that, where nobody else has told me, no, I can't do somebody something. Nobody else has tried to discourage me, but I just have kind of held myself back. And I've tried very hard over time to stop that. And I notice it now, whereas I didn't used to notice it. I notice it now. And I think I notice it because I had people that I considered to be mentors point that out to me along the way and then be the ones that encouraged me to not have that doubt, to at least take the steps that that I have control of in pursuing the things that I might want to do. So that was a long, rambly way.
No, you know, that. I think that that's so interesting that you say that, because I struggle with the same thing too. And I think, you know, a lot of people, especially women, struggle with having that confidence to just do it and to believe in yourself initially. But I think once you get started, the confidence builds. But that's so interesting you say that. Wow. So let's talk about your incredible career at NASA. One thing that I'm so curious about is what was running through your mind as you felt the initial acceleration of liftoff during your first time going into space?
I think what goes through your mind is, well, first of all, you know, and I don't know that the engineers who designed and built the space shuttle like purposely considered this. They probably did. And for one reason or another, it might not be for the reason I would have wanted them to. But the first minute and a half after launch on the space shuttle, those first 90 seconds, there's not a whole lot the crew can do, right? We monitor the systems, we're following along, we're communicating with the ground, but there's not real control we can have over the shuttle. There's not abort, nothing that we can really do. And in hindsight, I think that was just a spectacular thing, because as a human being, when the reality of 7 million pounds of thrust, you know, is coming up from behind you, lifting you out of gravity off the launch pad. I mean, it's like, first of all, you feel like you're kicked in the back. You're shaking like you never imagined you could shake before. You know, you're going really super fast and you just hope it's in the right direction, right? So you're doing all this monitoring. But in parallel with that, I think there's this human reaction of the big smile coming across your face, like not being able to control it. The smile comes across your face. Your arm rigidly goes up to like high five the person next to you. You're trying to be professional, you know, but you've got to have this like, woohoo, it's got to come out of you. And that 90 seconds goes by super fast as well. So you get all that human stuff out and then you're just focused. Not that you weren't during all of that too, but it's just incredible the amount of power that go from having been sitting there laying on your back peacefully, quietly napping even for a little while, you know, in the couple hours before launch, to just this, I mean, like overwhelming amount of power underneath you.
Wow. Oh gosh, I can't even imagine. Was it the same reaction the second time around, or since you knew what was coming? Yeah.
I mean, I think I knew, but it's just such a stunning thing to have happen. That, yeah, I just think your body reacts the same. You know, it's like it's all new again. But one of the things I'll tell you, in that question that I get a lot is, was I afraid? You know, was I afraid while this was happening? And I think as the crew, and you probably experienced this flying airplanes too, you know, on your big journey, that this is something I'm sure might have crossed your mind, is that it's a lot more difficult to watch somebody you love strap into a rocket and fly than it is to be the one flying, right? So true. I was felt like I was trained. I was ready to do this mission. I'm anxious about it. What's it going to feel like? I can't wait to get to space and do this work that I really care about. But in parallel with that, as part of that woohoo and excitement, just something in the back of my mind was like, man, I hope my family's okay watching this. I hope my 7-year-old son is, you know, feeling the excitement and isn't worried. I hope they're okay. Because that's a difficult thing to do. Yeah.
Wow. You know, when I took off to fly around the world, it didn't even occur to me that my mom would get emotional. I mean, obviously she's my mom. She's going to get emotional, but it just wasn't something that crossed my mind until I saw her crying so hard. And I started to tear up too. And I was like, Mom, it's okay. You know, aviation is so safe. And I've been planning for this for almost 5 years now. Like, have some faith.
Right.
And she was like, I have faith. I don't want you to do this. So I can relate to that. But that was tough to give my mom that hug and say, I'll be back, you know?
Yep.
Wow. Yep. So you have mentioned in a past interview that growing up, it never occurred to you that you could go to space someday. You admired it from afar and you had a passion for aviation and aerospace, but you didn't actually consider it being an astronaut. What was the one thing that motivated you to submit that application to the NASA astronaut program?
Well, I think so. This is where that self-doubt was definitely playing in. Because like I said, I was so, and I am still so thankful that I didn't have anyone in my life that was discouraging me, really, you know, that was saying, oh, you're a girl, your hair's dark, your, you know, feet are too big. I mean, none of that. They were, you know, nobody was telling me I couldn't do these kinds of things. And so I think that was very helpful. When I was a kid, I watched the moon landing, you know, I was 6 or 7 years old. And I think even at that age, I think you'll see with your son that young kids get it. You know, they get a lot. Even at 2, probably, he's already recognizing a lot of things. And I realized that was a really extraordinary thing to witness and have vivid memories of that with my family. And I thought it was really cool.
Right.
But I really didn't think that, it just didn't make sense that that could be something I could do.
Yeah.
As I got older, I wanted to know how things fly, right? And if you want to know how rocket or, you know, airplanes fly, why would you not want to know how rocket ships fly? And that led me down this NASA path. But it was quite a while into, I don't know, probably 8 or 9 years into the 10 years I worked as a NASA engineer at Kennedy Space Center.
Yeah.
Where I was watching astronauts come through as we got the spaceships ready for them. And I don't know, I'm probably slow, but I finally realized, I was like, wow, you know, 99.9% of an astronaut's job is not flying in space, right? And which is kind of a bummer, actually. But and then about 80% of it was a lot like, as best I could tell, like what I was already doing as a NASA engineer. And that at least got me thinking about it, like seeing these people, seeing them as people, and what they were doing, and like, man, I could relate to it in some way. Whereas before, it just seemed like this—that's something other special people get to do. Thing, why would they ever pick me?
Right.
And that encouraged me to just speak to the people I consider to be mentors. They did nothing more, really. They did nothing more than say, "Nicole, pick up the pen and fill out the application." And it's like they gave me permission to do that—that one thing I had control of. And believe me, when I see them, I thank them. Because that was huge. I don't think I would have done it without that.
Yeah. You know, mentors play such a big part in our lives. And some people you know, they think that they can do it without it, which they probably can, but it just helps you so much with your confidence, with the direction to go. So I can't stress that enough. Mentors will do you a lot good when you're pursuing something new for the first time. So it's good to hear that your mentors really came through for you.
And it makes you realize how much you need to be present too. Yeah. I mean, I think you've done this your entire, you know, your entire career. I think it's happening with this podcast too, is like, how do I make myself present, you know, for as many young people as I can, for whoever needs some kind of guidance or like lifting up in some way with what they're wanting to do. But it's huge. It's huge. I mean, I honestly believe that without them, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. First of all, I know that's a fact. And I think that what's so key in kind of the mentor thing is that they, if they really are and they know you, right? They will see things in you that you just don't see in yourself, right? They'll pull things out of you. They'll challenge you. They'll just tell you the obvious, pick up the pen and fill out the application. They feel comfortable doing that. And we should be really, really thankful and welcoming of that kind of support.
I agree. And you know, for me, Nicole, I had a mentor for different things. Like I had a mentor when it came to finding like my flying, and I had a mentor just personal development and confidence building. So I sought different things from different mentors. And, you know, I just keep hearing people refer to a mentor as one person. And so I want to share that there can be multiple mentors in your life, depending on what you're doing.
Yeah. And they might even be your parents, even though you don't want to. Right. You know, I think about that now, especially as I got older, I felt that more and more, even though I know that was that the kind of guidance that our parents give us, if they're supporting us, is very mentory. You know, it's just sometimes we don't want it to be our parents that are telling us these things.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And they know you best. So I get that. As a pilot who flew around the world, I have had my fair share of managing the risk, especially when it came to flying a single engine airplane by myself around the world, across oceans and remote lands. How did you, as an astronaut, mentally manage the risk that was involved with going to space?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I think one is that I had a real interest in doing it that was based not just on the adventure of it, right? It wasn't just, oh, it's going to be so cool to fly in space. I can't wait to float, you know, I'll be up there for, you know, wasn't, that was kind of the bonus to what I knew the work was about, and that I believe in the work that we're doing in space, that, you know, all of this stuff that we're doing as an international community on the space station is ultimately about improving life on Earth. And that, you know, that was something I was excited about being a part of, right? And I had worked on the vehicles. I had worked with the people that work on the spacecraft. And I can tell you, there is no more committed group of people to just the care and feeding of those spacecraft to support the people that are going to fly on them than the ones you find, you know, at the Kennedy Space Center who were doing that for the space shuttle program. And I was like, in awe of them. I was honored to have worked with them and seen that kind of thing going on.
Right.
And then I think the training, you know, you have to, I think there's something really good about not going blindly into something. I mean, you didn't just go hop into your single engine airplane and say, oh, dang, I ran out of gas, you know, what, whatever it might've been. Oh, there's nobody there to support me in that country that I want to fly into. I mean, there was, there's a lot of deliberate, diligent, purposeful preparation in doing something that has, you know, has a high level of risk associated with it.
Right.
And I think in that comes a comfort. And if there doesn't come a comfort in it, a balance of the risk reward kind of thing, then you probably need to walk away from it. Be honest with yourself and walk away from it. And I always felt like I was in the best place, like the people were doing whatever was humanly possible, that I was able to prepare in the best way possible. And I think that's what takes that and helps you with that. And it doesn't mean that you, that, oh, the risk goes away because I feel good
about
this. It's just that, whatever can be done to manage it, I think, is you have to understand that and know it's in place.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is for me, when I had my really tough moments, and even before I took off, you know, of course, you're going to have the nerves and you're going to have a little bit of self-doubt. But for me, it's very similar to what you said. It's the training and also the community. And for me, it was like, you know, all of these people are a part of this. And yeah, it's bigger than me. It's bigger than, you know, anything I could have imagined. And that gives you a sense of like, you know, it's not just me in the plane. Yes, physically, I'm the only one in the aircraft, but there's this energy that's helping me get around the world. Yeah. And that's what really helped get through the tough moments. Yeah. So, yeah, I can relate to what you were saying in terms of the community aspect of it.
Well, you know, what like I have this, and I got the picture. I'm so thankful to this guy that took this one picture. Mm-hmm. We were in the, this was second flight, actually, and it was daytime. And we're going out to the launch pad in that that Astro van, you know. And yeah, one of the things we would do, we'd leave our crew quarters building, do the wave, get in the van, and then we'd drive out to the launch pad. Right. And in the van at that time is like the director of flight crew operations. So the person who's over all of the astronaut operations and all of the flight crew stuff that goes into this. And they're on that van with you until you get to a point halfway out to the pad about, and they get dropped off at the launch control center. Okay. And when that happens, there's always people like standing in the field, you know, waving yeah. at the van, you know, we try right. to wave through little windows and stuff. But I remember I was sitting right next to the door, and I remember just like looking out as they got off the van, and I'm just kind of like poking my head out, looking out the window and wait, or at the door and waving. And one of my friends got a picture of me waving out that door.
No way. How cool.
And I'll tell you that, I think it speaks to exactly what you were just saying. That one thing, it's like, I mean, I remember being in that field, waving at crews, some of whom I, you know, I had worked with, but I didn't really know them. Right. And these were people that I really knew. And yeah. I knew they were excited for me, and they're watching me, you know, they're taking pictures as we drive by. Yeah. And I knew that in every second of that mission, they'd be there, you know, in one way or another, lifting me up in it. And wow. that is huge. It's so huge. And right. I certainly have really awesome pictures that I took from space. But when I think yeah. about my favorite moments of the whole experience, that, I mean, that is one where you're just like connecting in a whole different way.
Right.
To this group of supporting ground support team people.
Right. Wow. That's such a beautiful story. And you know, when you do things that are bigger than yourself gain or, you know, of course you're going to gain so much when you embark on a project or doing something like going to space or flying around the world. But when you do it for a bigger cause, it just makes you that much more resilient and feel like you're not in it alone and you're doing it for something that's much bigger than you are. So I can totally relate to that. And that's so great that you have that picture and that it takes you there. So one thing that I'm very curious about is you are a mother and you were a mom when you went up to space. How did you balance a family and a career, which, you know, for some it's challenging. And I think a lot of women coming into this industry are asking themselves that. So during your time in space, how did you balance it all with your family and your career?
Well, I think it was, you know, it had to be happening even before going to space, right? Mm-hmm. I am so thankful. There's a man in the other room in this house that I could not have done this without him. My husband, Chris, who just was supportive every step of the way. And I'll tell you, like, you know, like we talked before, it's a lot. This can be a real pain.
Right.
To your family, not just, not just the emotion of watching somebody launch on a rocket, but just the whole right. time and preparation. When I flew the first time, Roman was 7. So that means for like the, you know, half of his life, over half of his life was me training for that first mission where I was going to be, you know, 3 months or more on the space station. Wow. And that was over 50% of my time out of the country doing that training at all of our partner facilities. And without the support in my own like household for my husband, without, and within NASA too, the opportunity to bring my family with me to some of these places so they could see what I was doing and meet the people that I was working with. That was key. And you really do have to find, you have to be like, realize it can't just be all you trying to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rely on your family, your friends to support you, even though they might not want to do what you're doing. Right.
Right.
I'm sure, you know, a lot of people that you know probably wanted to go
yeah.
do that flight around the world, but there were probably a lot who are like, what is she thinking? Why would, you yeah. know, but they still supported you.
Right.
And that's key. And then I would say the other thing for us was that not ignoring that you have a family, right?
Right.
Like that they're looking at it, seeing it from a whole different perspective than you are, and trying mm-hmm. to involve them as much as possible. And one thing Chris and I did that I think was really, really key for us is we always tried to make sure that Roman, our son, felt like he was part of the crew, like he oh, knew wow. the people, he saw the places, he came out to, you know, with me to training, watch me in the big white suit getting in the swimming pool to figure out how to do a Aww. Spacewalk. And I think he understood it. So then the right. space time didn't seem quite as difficult or long or away as it might have otherwise.
Right. I'm just curious to ask, if you don't mind sharing, what was your son's reaction when you came back? Did he just think you were the coolest mom ever?
I think he just thought I was mom, you know, I mean, that's, I think no matter where we go and what we do, what our jobs are, that's, you know, how our kids feel. And
right.
When I got back the first time, which was after it was a little over 3 months in space, he was still seven. And it was kind of funny because he had already lost one of his front teeth. But he was, the second one was coming out. And I remember talking to him on the phone before landing. And he's like, yeah, I saved something for you. I had no idea what it was. And I get, the first thing I see when I see him is he's just so excited. And he just like opens his mouth as wide as he can. And he's pointing at this little tiny tooth that's just dangling, like dangling from the top of his mouth. And he just... I mean, it was like this connection, I guess he couldn't, you know, it's just something that he could share. And it was Aww. Awesome. Yeah.
That's so sweet.
Yeah. Wow. He was little too. He was a little
yeah. girl. Adorable. Wow. Yeah. Was there a time where you felt like giving up, just managing your career and your family? And if so, what encouraged you to stay the course?
Yeah, you know, I think we all go through that. We get to a yeah. point where it's like frustrating for whatever reason.
Right.
You know, stuff going on at home, being away too much, wondering, is the flight ever going to happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, delays.
Right.
You know, this was a process. This is years for people. You know, it's not just like you get in the astronaut office and 6 months later you're flying on a spaceship. I mean, it's years for it right. to happen. And, you know, just that kind of strain that can, and where you're just tired.
Right. I'm sure.
You know, and I think the same things, I think it is still the same things, you know, a husband who's going to, you know, family who's going to support you, try to find, you know, be there for whatever decision you make it at all, but are reminding you why you even started into this kind of thing.
Right.
You know, helping you with distraction, if that's what's needed, just getting you away.
Right.
And then bringing you back. And then it's up to you in the end, I think, to decide yeah. what you're going to do. But I think for me, it's always just been the people around me. And,
right.
And then having things that I enjoy outside of work, you know, working in my yard. I mean, every day, even now, when I start to get too tired to get frustrated, I'm like out in the yard. Or painting something, or working yeah. on something in the house, you know, just those kinds of things that I think are very healthy right. distractions to, you know, to get you to clear your brain a little.
Yeah, that's very good information that you're sharing. So I want to share with you, Nicole, when I was flying around the world, on the back end of it, I was getting ready. I was in Honolulu, Hawaii, getting ready to cross the Atlantic, sorry, the Pacific Ocean. And it was a 14 and a half hour flight ahead of me. And, you know, at that point, I was pretty tired and homesick. And I just kept thinking, like, gosh, why is this saved to the very end? Like, this is such a long flight. Mm-hmm. And so I remember telling myself, like, when I was trying to inspire myself and get myself motivated, I thought about astronauts. And I'm not kidding. I thought of you. And I thought, you know, I am sure in their journey, they've felt the same way that I have. Not that I'm comparing myself to an astronaut, but I thought of you all. And that really gave me a lot of courage to be strong and to finish strong. And I'm so curious, what do you look to in those moments? And you might have already answered this, but I'm just wondering what you look to in those moments where you're just like, gosh, this is really hard.
Yeah, I think, you know, honestly, I think about people like you too. I think it goes both ways. It's all relative, right? And what we see in each other. And knowing that there's not anyone who isn't at some point feeling like, I don't know if I can do this. And that you're at that point of being so tired. And but there's that old motto, pleasure is the pain kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
And when you get through stuff like that, how just, you know, the adrenaline comes out of nowhere somehow and you find the strength and all of that.
Right.
There's a couple places I can think of where for me that really stood out. One of them was in our training. We did this national outdoor leadership training. We were like 10 days in the Utah Canyonlands. And I was never a hiker. I was never a climber. You know, I consider myself aerobically challenged. So you're not a runner or anything like that.
Right.
And we're out doing this training. I mean, every day of that training. And then I could say the same thing for one of the cold weather trips we did where the snow was up thigh high and you're trudging through that every day and you just got to keep going and thinking, I've gone from never doing this before to now I'm having to do this. I have to do it, you know, just and thinking about the other five people I was with and how, if I didn't do it, it would bring all of them down too. But also knowing, and I think this was key, knowing that if I had a challenge and I needed their support, they would be there and they would help me. And I think they felt the same way about me, that if there was something going on during that training, that they knew they could count on me to help them. And I think that's key. It's coming back to the same kind of thing, the people around you and stuff. But just knowing that they're going to be the ultimate professional in all of it, and they will have your back, and also that you're going to have a good time while you're doing this. And the other thing, like during the flight, was spacewalking. That's probably one of the most dangerous things we do, right? You've trained for years to do that. You're going outside in your own little spaceship. And 6.5 hours seems to go by really, really slowly.
Okay.
And then you're back inside and you're like, how'd I get done with that? And there were times during that where I was like, man, I think we've only been out here 3 hours and we got
three
more hours to go. What am I going to be able to do this? Right. And again, you've got your crewmate out there with you. You've got the people inside that are helping talk you through it all. And it's incredible how you can get through something like that. That's one of the most challenging things you've ever done because you've got the support of all these people around you.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Wow. And another thing that I'm curious about is when you came back to Earth, what was it like in terms of coping and readjusting to everyday life? How was that for you?
It was fine. I mean, I enjoyed it even. I think there's a point where, you know, after you land on the runway, you're sitting in the shuttle on the runway and, you know, going through all the checklists to get the vehicle configured and everything. And feeling the weight of gravity. And you just sit there. I remember both times thinking, wow, an hour ago, I was in space.
Wow.
Cool is that, you know, and now I'm back on Earth and they open the hatch and all the smells of Earth come in and you just feel, it feels surprising and yet normal all kind of at once. And I loved coming back both times. And I felt like it was like I had just done something that's now going to set me on this new path, whatever, whatever that is. And, you know, certainly thankful to be able to have my family, to see my family. And you know, that's probably the hardest part about being on these missions is that you don't have them with you, you know? But no, I always, and I've wondered about that. I think in the earlier days of like Apollo and stuff, it was, there was a lot more of a, like a psychological kind of questioning about, man, I just walked on the moon.
Yeah.
How do I come back and walk here on Earth with all these normal people, you know? Yeah. And I don't remember feeling anything like that at all. I felt like it was something that was just going to opening up new opportunities for me to do new things. And it has. It's been really wonderful.
Right. You know, the next morning that when I woke up after completing the flight, I just thought to myself, like, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Like, did I just go around the world? And like, here I am just waking up, you know, back, back in my community. And even going to Starbucks, like I enjoyed it so much. And I just thought like, I just come back to life and I just live it the way I was living before. Like how crazy is that?
But yeah, look I can at relate you to and that. Look how you've used the experience. I mean, and I think there's, this is what I find too. I mean, there's things that we learn as we're doing it that we might not even really realize we're learning them. And then we're bringing them into our day-to-day lives after that. We want to share the experience. I think that's key. It's not like you just file it away in your little, you know, brain memories of, ooh, I went to space. Yay for me kind of thing. I think there's, ooh, I flew around the world. I think you need to use it, you know? Okay. Right. So great. What now, what do I do with that? What action do I take as a result of it? And that can become pretty compelling, I think.
Well, I want to now transition over to your current life and the things that you are doing. You are an artist, which I think is so cool. I really do. I love art. I love paintings. I love just the artistic things of way of doing things. Were you always a passion of art? Were you always passionate of art, or was that something you just kind of established when you got back?
Always, I would say, just grew up kind of artsy, craftsy. You know, I would never. I actually feel like I'm kind of stretching it, and that I might be, in some ways, disrespectful to real artists when I use the word artist. But I think that's all. It's all kind of relative too. I mean, that's what I feel like I'm doing. So it kind of makes sense. But I always wanted to create things. I liked, you know, woodworking, drawing, painting, all of it. And when I grew up, many years before you, you know, back in the 60s, 70s kind of time frame, I remember my mom, she was pottery and macrame rugs and or macrame and hooked rugs and things like that. And she would include us in all of that, my sister and I, and, you know, developed a love for it that way. And if I was going to get to a ballet lesson or something, it's because, you know, she got me there. And so I was introduced to it early on and really enjoyed just creating things.
Right.
And started to paint along the way, just purely experimental, nothing, no training or anything. And was very fortunate to be able to take that to space with me. Which is what I think really kicked it into gear for me. Like that opportunity to paint in space.
Right.
When I was starting to think, when I did finally think about retiring from NASA, I'm like, how do I share this experience in a meaningful way, in an interesting, different way with audiences that might not even know there is a space station? And everyone should know there is a space station. And and art, I just kept coming back to art as a way to do that.
You know, you have had this incredible experience that's only so many people have had, and you've seen planet Earth in a way, again, that only so many people have. But the fact that you're able to come back and translate it through your paintings and the art that you're doing, that's an artist, you know, like I think it's incredible. And I've seen your paintings, and it's so fascinating to see Earth through your eyes, through the work that you're doing. And you are also the first astronaut to paint a watercolor in space, which that's so cool.
You know, who knew? It's like, and that's a funny thing to me. It's like, it never crossed my mind to even think about that.
Right.
When I was thinking about bringing the paint kit up. And again, I, you know, these people in our lives, I'm so thankful to this woman, Mary Jane Anderson, who was one of our flight crew equipment people. So she was a person who helped us get our stuff ready to fly, right. All of the official stuff. And then this little bag of, you know, personal things that we can take with us.
Yeah.
And she just I remember her encouraging me, hey, Nicole, you know, think about it. You're going to be up on the space station for months.
Yeah.
You will have free time. Is there something you enjoy doing on Earth that you want to bring with you? And that's where I would not have thought about it on my own. You know, that's where the paint kit came from.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was like this, it's one of the most special memories to me.
Right.
Because I think it reflects that we're living there now, right? We're not just working in space. We're living there for extended periods of time. We have to bring the human and human spaceflight with us, I think. We can't just leave that at home. So.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I love that. I really do. It's so memorable. And it's just, I love it because you are in such a technical, very high stress environment. And there you are, you know, painting. I think it's so beautiful. And that's how we should see art is, you know, we need to incorporate it into STEM because it helps with our creativity. It helps with our health, our stress levels and all of that. So I thought that was so cool.
Well, and finding our best solutions, right? I kind of look at it like using your whole brain.
Right.
You know, don't just divide it in halves and only use half of it.
Right.
And when you look, I mean, I've discovered over time, a majority of my colleagues in the technical world have some creative outlet, something that they're doing that's just purely joyful to them, you know, and human for them. And in space, man, you know, since the earliest cosmonauts, astronauts, there's been, you know, color pencil drawings by Alexei Leonov. There's been musical instruments, I think, on every spacecraft that's ever flown. There's on the space station right now, there's, I think, two guitars, a keyboard, a flute.
Wow.
You know, we make drums out of things.
Right.
If you weren't a photographer before you got there, but you become one. People are writing poetry. My friend Karen Nyberg quilting while she was on the station. I mean, it's, I think there's more of a balance in that whole brain thing than, you know, than we give ourselves credit for too. And, I think that's the human side of human spaceflight too. I don't think we can ever go anywhere off the planet, again, without that consideration for how are humans going to have this outlet that we just naturally need.
Right. You know, it's interesting that you talk about that outlet, because for me, you know, I didn't go to space, but I had so many rich experiences around the world. I mean, it was 28 countries. It was across 5 continents. And it was, I mean, it was 145 days, which seems long. But when you think of it going around the world, every stop was relatively short. And I had met so many people. I had heard so many incredible stories. And I just thought, you know, this needs to get out there. And I always wondered why Jerry Mock, the first woman who ever flew solo around the world, back in 1964, she had the experience. She wrote a book about it, but then it kind of stopped for her there. Like she never went back to flying and she never really spoke about the trip after that. And so I wanted to do things differently. So I started this podcast as an outlet to share some of those experiences, but most importantly, talk about the reoccurring topics and conversations that I was having with women around the world. So that is so important. If you can take an experience in your life that was very moving and have an outlet for it and translate it to other people in different ways, I think it's really cool.
Yeah. And I love that you're doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And what you were doing all along, you know, during the flight, leading up to the flight, afterwards, in terms of communicating it, getting out to different organizations and places to share it. And you're building on it, right? You keep, I think it's there and you're building on it in a very positive way. That's why, I mean, I felt so fortunate, you know, to retire from NASA and then to be able to bring what I love together, the art and the space, in a way that I think is, I hope is, you know, is meaningful. And,
right.
You know, like through work with the Space for Art Foundation and, you know, with these kids and stuff, where I never thought, I mean, when I retired, I thought, oh, I'll be doing my own artwork and sharing, you know, what we're doing in space and how that benefits us here on Earth through my own art. And never did I think that the most exciting and like I'd found my next mission would come through painting spacesuits with kids, you know, around the world. And that, it's like I went to space to get to do these things now. And I think we have to find that. What's that next, you know, that next thing.
Right. So I have pre-ordered a copy of your book, which is titled, Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It, which comes out on October 12th. I cannot wait. Tell us about your book and the message that you're trying to share with the readers.
Well, I think, first of all, I'll say it's not a memoir.
Okay.
There are, of course, stories, spaceflight experience. I try to share that. And there's little stories about growing up and influences and things like that. But really, I just felt like people needed to understand how the way we have come together as this international community in space on this mechanical life support system, you know, the space station, the International Space Station, how we've done that peacefully and successfully for over 20 years, and the ways we've gone about that just seem to be this really beautiful model for how we should be doing things down here on Spaceship Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's everything from how we interact with each other as an international community. It's to the way we've technically built the space station to solve certain problems. Right. It's and it's considering the fact that we've done that to mimic as best we can what Earth does for us naturally, right?
Right.
And when we live on the space station, I mean, I get it. It's like people look at me like, well, yeah, you're talking about 7 people on a space station. You know, that's nothing compared. It's like we got 7 billion plus here on the planet. I'm like, yeah, you know, I realize that the numbers, but holy moly. We go and we live on this mechanical place in space. Mm-hmm. And every day, in order for us to survive, to survive, we have to be aware of how much CO2 is in our atmosphere, how much clean drinking water we have, the integrity of our thin metal hull, the health and well-being of all of our crewmates. Because if one of those things is not in place, then we as a crew, not just Nicole, won't survive in that place. Right?
Yeah.
And then if we take care of all those things, it's incredible how you can then thrive in that place and do the science and maintain the station and all of these things with the tens of thousands of people that are down on Earth supporting you.
Yeah.
And it's just everything about it speaks to why we need to be living like crewmates here on Spaceship Earth and not passengers. And that's a big difference, those two things.
Gosh, I love that message. And I just want to share with you. So when I was flying across the international countries, you know, going from one country to the other, you know, on my GPS, I could see the border. It was pretty, you know, significantly outlined. And I don't know why, Nicole, like in my head, I just for some reason thought that there was going to be a barrier on that border. Like, I don't know what made me think that, but you know, as I'm flying, I'm kind of looking for it. And I think, well, wait a minute, there are no borders. And, you know, like I know this, but it was different when I was, you know, in the moment. And it just dawned on me that borders are man-made. We are all of the human race. And it's so sad to see that these man-made borders are what separates people from really experiencing life or having an education. And I can tell you, the girls that I met in Spain were very similar to the girls that I met in Indonesia and in Afghanistan. Like, we all think the same. But it's it's mind blowing how much divided we are within ourselves as humans. So I just cannot wait to read your book and to, you know, reinforce this message that we all are one. And that's how we need to really view it as we go forward on treating our planet well and coming together as, you know, not individual countries, but just the human race and working that way in the future. So I love that message. I can't wait to read the book.
Thank you. And it, you know, yeah. You're saying it's funny how we can look at these things that are so complex, right?
Right.
I mean, I think about getting to space, living there even for a short period of time. I think about mm-hmm. you flying around the world. That's not an insignificant thing to do. There's, you know, the technical complexity in that is
yeah.
huge.
Right.
And yet in all of it, it really does come down to the people and the simple lessons that come from it, right?
Right.
These connections we make, this total understanding of the interconnectivity
right.
of it all. And I mean, I remember very early on looking out the window of the spaceship and just being like, oh my gosh, we live on a planet.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that, right?
You yeah.
learned that in kindergarten, right?
And no,
then, like
I believe
you're saying,
it.
It's like, oh yeah, we live on a planet.
Yeah.
Hey, we're all Earthlings.
Right.
You know, and the only border that matters, thin blue line of atmosphere that blankets
yeah.
and protects us all.
That's so
it.
True.
Otherwise, it's like these constructs that we put in place for
right.
for ourselves or against ourselves, actually, in some ways. And yeah, coming to grips with the fact that we really do have a responsibility to each other, to all the other
yeah.
life we share the planet with,
right.
to the planet itself, ensuring that we maintain the life support system that it's put in place for us.
Right.
That's
so
pretty
true.
Key. Yeah.
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 Oh, man. I can't wait. October 12th. So let's talk about the future of space, because this is really a hot topic in the news right now. What is your thoughts on space tourism? And do you plan on participating someday, perhaps with your family?
I would love to.
Yeah.
I will never, you know, there's always the hope of that, right? I'd love that trip to the moon. I think a family trip to the moon would be outstanding. And I think in my lifetime, even as the old lady that I am, I think that I could hope for that, you know,
mm-hmm.
maybe count on that happening someday. But I'm excited about what's going on right now. Seeing I just had the opportunity to participate quite closely with this Inspiration 4 mission that just took place.
Okay.
You know, this four person, all civilian, all non-professional astronaut crew that went to space for 3 days and orbited the Earth. And, you know, on top of it had this mission of generosity for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And incredible to see that happen.
Yeah.
And all four of those people were trained and ready to do that by the time they flew to space. There could not have been a better four people to have represented us that way.
Wow.
On this crew. And then seeing, you know, these initial starts with Virgin and, you know, Blue Origin doing the suborbital flights, those
right.
are going to evolve over time, right? We're going to think back and wonder why we thought it was so crazy to have those 5-6 people floating around in that Virgin Galactic spaceship. When at some point, you know, people are going to be flying from point A to point B in something like
right.
that, you know, a mode of transportation versus, thinking of it as just a, you know, a 5-minute tourist suborbital flight.
Right.
When I think about, you know, the motivations of a lot of these people that are helping on a commercial kind of private side, put this in place.
Mm-hmm.
It looks at this point like it's all about the tourist thing. It looks at this point like it's about some big joyride, you know, that
right.
somebody who can afford it right now gets to do.
Right.
When in reality, it's about ultimately lifting the things that are harmful to us off the planet, like into this relatively benign, neutral environment of space. You know, I think
right.
of things like space-based solar power, you know,
okay.
where we could lift all of these harmful things that where we're generating our energy into space to provide that in the cleanest possible way.
Wow.
And there's all kinds of things like that.
Yeah.
That the space environment is going to make possible for us. And is already, we wouldn't be doing this right here today.
Yeah.
Without a lot of the communications development that's gone into us flying in space. In fact, I'm pretty sure we're bouncing off a satellite somewhere to make this happen.
Right. It's fascinating. In terms of all the innovation that's happening in aerospace, what are you most excited about?
Wow, this might sound silly. Well, I'm really excited about, you know, greener fuels, us figuring out how we do, you know, this last year, gosh, it's almost 2 years now, isn't it, of the whole COVID thing where we kind of had to shut stuff down, right?
Yeah.
And I had been traveling like a maniac before that.
Right.
You know, I was doing like day trips to Dubai and, you know, things like that for these events that I was supporting. And discovered in this time that we can do a lot of what we travel for from our own homes because we have this kind of virtual communication that we can do.
Right.
But then thinking about it, like, man, I want to go to Dubai again. I want to visit my family in the UK. I want to see Iceland someday, you know, that we shouldn't have to take those things away from us either, but we need to find solutions that make sense for a longer term. And I think in the aerospace industry, we're going to start to see a lot of that happening. Kind of this recreation of what it means to get from point A to point B. And then I'm still looking forward to my flying car.
Oh, yeah.
I'm much older than you. When I was a kid, that whole Jetsons thing, man, we were supposed to have them by now. So I'm still counting on something like that.
Yeah, no, of course. Oh, man, me too. I want to ask, are you seeing more women be a part of this innovation?
I am. And I don't, you know, I struggle because my visibility tends to be more within the NASA world.
Yeah.
And I think NASA has just over time has just done such a wonderful job.
Okay.
Just bringing in, I kind of joke about like people of all flavors, you know?
Oh yeah.
And you know, we can use the example in these last couple of years, we've been celebrating the 50th anniversary of Apollo missions, right? And when we look at like the mission control room where there were no women in the front room for Apollo missions, you know, Poppy Northcutt was an engineer in the back room somewhere doing really insane calculations for things. In Launch Control Center in Florida, there was one woman, Joanne Morgan, like smack dab in the middle of that control center, the only engineer, female engineer there. And now you look at Mission Control and the Launch Control Center, not only are they run by extraordinary women, but you look in the on the consoles and it's just this mix of humanity.
Right.
You know, you're not saying, oh, where's Joanne? You know, trying to find her in this, you know, this crowd of people not like her. It's just this mix of humanity. And I'm not sure how NASA did it and how the you know, the space contractors did it, but we need to find what that awesome sauce is and get it out there. Because I think statistically, engineering wise, pilot wise, in the aviation industry, just in general, I mean, the numbers are still maybe double digits, double digits.
Right.
And that's not okay.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree with you more. But I do agree with you on the sense that we are seeing more women be a part of this innovation. And it's exciting. It really is. It's about time. And I think we will just go that much farther by being more inclusive than before. You know, second to last question here. Okay. For those who plan to visit space someday, what is your biggest piece of advice to them?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, be prepared, but I think just really go into the whole experience where, and I would ask people to do this down here on Earth too. I think we don't do enough of this down on Earth, is just open yourself completely, mind, eyes, heart, all of it, to just to the awe and wonder of what you'll experience, to the new perspective that you'll have from that vantage point. I mean, I say the same thing to people I know are flying for the first time. You know, they're getting off the earth, looking back and, you know, making a connection to a place in a just a totally different way. The respect that you can have for what surrounds you that you might not get when you're just burying yourself in your life day to day.
Yeah.
To really open yourself to that. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Great advice. Wow. And last question. This is a question that I ask all of our podcast guests, which is, what is the best piece of advice you've received as a woman in aviation?
Wow. It's something I use all the time. And I'm going to build a couple things. One is, then you can say airplane, you can say rocket ship.
Yeah.
Doesn't care if you're a boy or girl. Right?
Yeah.
That was huge to me. To just, oh yeah, I'm right. going and taking flying lessons. This airplane doesn't care who, you know, it just
yeah.
needs somebody to manage it properly, to do all the things you're supposed to do. And it doesn't know or care. I mean, I give it the benefit of the doubt about caring. It doesn't have that
right.
ability. We do that to ourselves, right?
Yeah.
We put those restrictions on ourselves, or other people are laying them on us who shouldn't be, right?
Right.
And then I will tell you, because I think this applies to everything, and I have it right here, like I've had in my office every day since I first saw it. It's this little motto of, here's how we can, not why we can't.
Oh, wow.
And I, you know, again, that's boy or girl, but I would say that young women really need to hear that, is that you need to approach everything you're doing from the standpoint of, how can we make this happen? How can I make this happen for myself? How
right.
can I take advantage in a good way of the people that surround me, that love me, that will lift me up? You know,
yeah.
not why I can't do it.
Right.
And, you know, believing there's a solution to every challenging problem when you go into it. And
right.
just that positive mind shift on everything, I think, opens up opportunities that might not have been there otherwise.
Wow. I love it. Oh, my goodness. Well, Nicole, that's all I have for you today. And I just want to say thank you for joining us. And thank you for all of the important work that you're doing, both in space and here on the ground. And you're such an inspiration. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
My pleasure, Shasta. Thanks for including me. And I love what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you.